obviously he was towards the end of his life, and he was in a different mode. And you know, yet he's still Ed. Yet, you know, one of the most important things is I'm a filmmaker. That's what I do. And he'd often say, Lucia, you know, maybe people won't understand this, but we're committed to trying. And that was what I loved about him. He wasn't about the end game. He was about being committed to taking huge risks. And he often would say, you know, you're the bigger risk taker. You don't have a husband. You don't, you know, you're out on your own. And I'd say, well, that's ridiculous. But I mean, we're lucky. We're lucky we get to do what we do. I understand that. And he did too. And we're lucky to be able to share it.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Met was Lucia Small, the filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, and one of my guests today, reflecting on her partner, her filmmaking partner of many years, the late Ed Pincus. And when she talks about him, she gets emotional, understandably, and there's a lot of that going on in this conversation. It's pretty intense. It kind of covers a lot of terrain, like their work and the tension in their relationship, the tension in her relationship with Ed's wife, and it's a lot of this is also explored, as well as the final months of Ed's life in Lucia and Ed's new documentary, One Cut, One Life, which is going to have its screening at the New York Film Festival. You're listening to FilmWax Radio, episode number 241. As I said, Lucia Small is one of my guests today. We're going to play another segment first in just a moment with two critics who are assigned to cover the New York Film Festival, which is about to start in a couple of days on Friday the 26th at Lincoln Center. The two gentlemen are my friend Godfrey Cheshire, who has been on this program some time ago, actually, and also Scout Tafoya. This is my first guest named Scout. So I'm especially pleased to welcome Scout to the podcast. Again, together they've been assigned to cover the festival for RogerEbert.com, which is, of course, a burgeoning website for film reviews, which in part is edited by Matt Zollerseitz, a much respected critic in his own right. And hopefully we're going to have Matt on the show in a couple of months. But in the meantime, I'm more than pleased to invite Godfrey back and invite Scout to talk about their reflections on the New York Film Festival, what they've seen so far, what they're looking forward to seeing. And you can read their reviews on RogerEbert.com. And then we'll have Lucia on. Lucia has not been on before, though I've been friends with her for some time. I met her back in 2007 or 8, when she and Ed released their penultimate documentary, The Axe in the Attic, at the New York Film Festival. And Lucia and I hung out, and then we got together a few times, and we got to know each other. We've been checking in here and there throughout the last bunch of years. So finally, it's such a pleasure to bring Lucia on the show. You know, I should say as a footnote, I never really knew Ed Pincus, and he is considered the father of the personal documentary. He was in the, you know, in a early around the time of the Maisels and the Pennebakers of the world were making, I would say, concert films and political films. They weren't really turning the camera toward themselves. Ed really did that first, which spawned a subsequent generation of personal documentary filmmakers like Lucia, like Doug Block, like Ross McElwee, and many others. Ed made this seminal film called Diaries, which, if you can get your hands on it, I really recommend you do and see it. It's a crazy mess of a film, but it's groundbreaking at the same time. And you can't ever quite believe what you're watching. And at the same time, it feels just like regular life. So it's this interesting blend. And I did email back, must have been at least a year and a half ago, with Ed, because I was trying to get him on the podcast. And I I guess he was up in Vermont where he lived, and I just didn't make it happen. I kind of kick myself and take it as a lesson learned that if you feel the immediacy and the importance of having meeting somebody who could be pretty important to you, you should make the effort as best you can. And so I kind of regret that I didn't just get in a car and drive up to Vermont and make it happen. Then again, I might have felt like it was intrusive, and I don't know. So it is what it is. But this is no bad alternative to have Lucia Small on the podcast. So the festival starts the New York Film Festival on Friday 26th. It goes through October 12th, and there's lots of great films in the slate. So you should go to the website and check it out while tickets are still available for various films. Lucia's film is sold out, but you can go on standby or check the box office. Sometimes tickets get returned, and see if you can get into this if you're interested after you listen to this conversation. Again, her film is called One Cut, One Life, and we're going to play the segment with myself and Godfrey and Scout, and then we'll go into my conversation with Lucia Small. I'd like to welcome Godfrey Cheshire and Scout Tafoya, who together are providing New York Film Festival coverage for RogerEbert.com. Now, let me ask you, is Chaz waiting for the emails to come in with your reviews and your articles, or does she actually read them through and edit them herself? I'm just kidding.
You are kidding, but we don't report to Chaz. We don't send our articles to her.
She's not the one that's in charge?
Well, she's the publisher, and right. Matt Zoller Seitz, my good friend, is the editor-in-chief, and Scout and I both send our articles to Brian Tellerico.
That's my understanding of how to pronounce
Brian. What's his name?
Tellerico, I think.
Tellerico.
Yeah, and he's a very good editor to deal with, and so he's the one that gets our copy in Chicago and edits it with Matt.
Got it. Wow. Yeah, I was just kidding. That, by the way, was the sonorous voice of Godfrey Cheshire.
Sonorous or not, it's my voice.
It is your voice. It is, indeed. And welcome, I should say to you, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, it's good to be back here. I enjoyed doing it before.
It was a pleasure, and it's a pleasure again.
I was there last time as a filmmaker rather than as a critic, right?
Yeah. That's right, exactly.
Different hats.
Right, yeah. That's definitely a conversation for the future, but I would wonder how you do that balancing act, because right now I know you're deep in the thrust of doing both of those things very much so.
Right? That's right. I'm working on some other film projects, not a documentary this time, something else. But I'm having to sort of balance the things.
Yeah.
I will point out, and maybe a good place to start here, is that this is my 35th year covering the New York Film Festival, and this is Scout's first. So we make an interesting sort of team in that regard, I think.
Yeah.
Contrasting views of this festival just from that perspective.
Did you know each other before?
We met just once earlier. Okay. Scott, you want?
Yeah.
The origin story of this partnership.
Yeah. Keith Ulick threw a party for a friend of ours who was moving to Los Angeles, and I, of course, have been reading Godfrey for a lot of years before meeting him, and had heard him actually on our friend Peter's podcast, which everybody should listen to.
Who's? You're plugging somebody else's film podcast?
Sorry.
No, by all means, please. It's Who's that? No, who's?
Peter Labuza. It's called The Cinephiliacs. I think you guys are separate enough in what you cover that it's okay to plug Peter.
I don't review films myself. I bring on reviewers to talk about it. Yeah, it's very true. Well, Scout, it's good to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This is, I think this is the first podcast I've ever been on. So,
oh, okay.
First festival, first podcast.
Well, I have that over Cinephiliacs as well.
That's right.
Actually, I will say that I was finally invited onto someone else's podcast, but they book so far ahead that I'm literally booked for next June. It's the projection booth?
Okay, yep.
All right. That is so much fun. So I'm really looking forward to that. They just find all the... movies that have kind of become like infamous more and for like or B movies and,
right,
and
right, right.
obscurities and things of that nature. And so I chose Rock and Roll High School, which
good choice.
Can't wait. I hope I can. I have a year to prepare, for God's sakes. Well, anyway, let's get into it. You guys, Godfrey, you mentioned this is your 35th time. How do you think, in the scheme of things, that this particular slate holds up?
Well, you know, I think to me, it's the festival has been remarkably consistent over the years. I mean, every year there are ones that you think shouldn't be in there, but they're also, you know, I was thinking back when I first started covering the festival in the 80s, I was writing for a paper in North Carolina weekly, and I would come up here every year to spend as much of the festival as I could take away from North Carolina. And every year it seemed to me that the festival accounted for about half my 10 best list, which is really saying something considering the main slate is not that big and one sees hundreds of movies a year. I think their record of really having high quality slates is pretty great. And, you know, I really like this festival in the sense that the main slate is only about 30 films, because you go to somewhere like Toronto or Cannes or something like that, you're just completely overwhelmed and you can only see a small fraction, whereas here you can see the majority and you have a good sort of picture of what's going on in world cinema. So I think so far this year, I think I've seen two films that will be on my 10 best list, and we're only one week in. So
that is pretty significant. Which two are they?
The two are La Sapienza by Eugene Green and Beloved Sisters by Dominique Graff. I thought both are really extraordinary films, and I think Scout and I actually agree on these two.
Yeah. La Sapienza was a marvel. It really sort of speaks in such a peculiar and beautiful language that you don't get to see, you know, just sort of week to week. So somebody like Eugene Green is a delight to spend time with. And Beloved Sisters, I was completely floored by. I'm not even exactly sure what I was expecting, but sort of every new scene and every new development and every new technique, the film is sort of overflowing with all this sort of grammatical excess, and it all worked for me beautifully. I think that's probably the highlight of the festival for me so far.
Picked up by Kino Lorber, La Sapienza. Yeah, in fact, I expect to be probably talking to Eugene soon when he comes in, I'm hoping. But yeah, that's pretty amazing. So we should mention that as we talk, which it's like this going into the second week of press and industry screenings. So I don't think we've seen a ton of films, you know, maybe a small percentage of the films that are coming up. And then I don't know if either of you have had opportunities to see some of the films that are in the New York Film Festival prior to the festival at other festivals, but no? Okay. All right. So that's great, too, because then you can't really do it.
Yeah, we're seeing everything sort of as a
fresh, with fresh eyes.
There you go.
Right, yeah. And Ebert hasn't covered him. Right. So what else? What would you be anticipating? Do you have any that you're really looking forward to?
Well, I mean, for me, I guess I'm very much looking forward. Obviously, I think that anybody you would talk to would probably say the two big premieres, Inherent Vice and Gone Girl. Definitely looking forward to those. But also for me personally, Matthew Amalric's The Blue Room. Mm-hmm. He certainly acts more than he directs, but the few films he's made are really excellent. And his film a few years ago, On Tour or Tournée, I guess in French, was one of the best films I saw that year. I was completely in love with that, and sort of have been looking forward to him making another film. I unfortunately missed the last one he made. It only played in New York for about a day. So this is, I'm really excited to see that.
I guess the two dramatic films that I'm most looking forward to are Foxcatcher and Whiplash. Both of those have been at other festivals and have gotten really extraordinary reactions. And so I'm curious about those. And the other film that I'm really excited about is Citizen Four, the Laura Poitras documentary about Edward Snowden, which was just announced a few days ago, was not on the original slate, and they're having the world premiere of that. So that's a real event, I think.
Yeah. I agree, right? Yeah, right. It's been kind of kept on the down low. What do you think of the notion of all the world premieres? I don't even think they care that much here at this. After talking to Kent Jones, you know, they have a couple, like, you know, there are with Gone Girl and Inherent Vice, but I don't think that's a huge priority for them. They, you know, they're kind of known for, on one respect, for the best of the fests.
Yeah.
They're bigger than that now, but that is one component of what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's understandable the way that they approach thing and not obsessing about world premieres like so many festivals do, which I think is really kind of obnoxious. I would rather see the best films, whether they've been at other festivals or not. And in fact, I like having a festival that has these films that you've read about at foreign festivals that you can't go to see, you know. So
yeah,
it's fine. And I think it's good for them to have a couple, you know. It's really, yeah, you know, feather in the cap kind of thing. And sure, they want to be able to advertise some world premieres, but I'm glad that they don't obsess too much about it.
One of the things I did also talk to Kent Jones about, I was careful how I worded it, because the films like Whiplash, which you mentioned, Godfrey, and also the new Safdie brothers film, Heaven Knows What, and then Alex Ross Perry's follow-up to The Color Wheel, which is called Listen Up, Philip, there seems to be a kind of a tapping into a certain vein of New York indie, which, you know, is seems really obvious this year, because that just didn't exist in prior years. Godfrey's handing over the mic. Mike, Godfrey, you can speak very eloquently on New York indie films, can't you? Anyway, I was wondering if you thought there was a kind of a real attempt here to tap into that for obvious reasons, you know.
Oh, I mean, obviously, I, you know,
it could be just that they ignored them too long.
I think that they have a pretty good history of connection to the New York, you know, underground or avant-garde or indie,
okay,
filming. I mean, I think back to Stranger Than Paradise and things like that. And also, we just came out of seeing a film by Abel Ferrara, who is a filmmaker that I have
true.
A very mixed opinion of. But they have been consistent in supporting him. And he's, I think, very much a quintessential New York independent filmmaker.
They did show Go-Go Girl, Go-Go Tales, rather. I wish they'd show Go-Go Girls. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think that that's anything new, and I'm glad to see it's something that they're continuing.
Right.
Yeah.
Any thoughts? Scout.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... I remember when they announced the lineup and how, you know, grateful the reaction from the filmmakers was, because, of course, it's, you know, it is a big deal that, you know, you walk out of the Walter Reed and head to the subway and you see the, you know, you recognize bits of the streets that you've just seen in the films, you know what I mean? And to do that and place them next to these, you know, major art house events from all over the world, it's, you know, it's, I don't know, I think it's a lovely tradition to keep up. And they certainly couldn't have picked more, you know, provocative and idiosyncratic artists. I mean, Alex Ross Perry, I really, really appreciate that he's, you know, speaking a very, very singular language when he makes movies. And the Safdies, I mean, that film was like a bolt of lightning, you know. They're very interesting artists. So, in the one sense, it's great that they're New York artists, but they're just great filmmakers. And,
yeah,
and, you know, love them or hate them, they're doing different and interesting things.
Yeah. Well, it certainly opens up their audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, because, maybe that's what I was more getting to, you know, is that their films played for a particular type of audience in New York primarily, and now it's sort of like the New York Film Festival is in a way like its, you know, channel to the rest of the, you know, film world.
There's definitely, I mean, there's no better place to see a premiere than, you know, the Walter Reed or Alice Tully, or even, you know, the theaters across the street, the Bunin. So I think that they are definitely giving them a very, you know, a sort of great, what's the word I'm looking for, introduction, I guess, you know, to audiences around here. And I think that it's the best possible circumstances to see those films. So I think there's definitely something to what you're saying.
Yeah. And also, you know, they do have to create the relationships. You mentioned a couple of filmmakers before, Godfrey, that they bring back. It's almost as though the relationship matters as much, if not more, than this particular film that year. So, like Abel Ferrara, they have a real allegiance to his career and to the careers of filmmakers like that, you know. And so they'll bring them back over and over, and they can need to kind of foster new relationships. Is there RogerEbert.com have a particular? Do they have a particular type of film that they want you to cover, or is it really? I mean, are you assigned the particular films?
We're assigned to cover the films that haven't been covered at other festivals.
I got
basically.
You. That makes a lot of sense.
It does. Well, it's an easier sort of task for us to just focus on those films rather than trying to cover the whole festival. And it does make sense, because the other films, people can go look up those reviews and other festival coverage
right on the same website. Although it's, I guess occasionally it might be a different might be a different edit, but not really going to affect too many people.
Well, you know, the editor also said to us if we had something strong to say about a film okay. that was different from what had been written before, we're free to do that. And right. I don't know if I'm going to take advantage of that unless I see something that really just blows my mind that
right.
I don't feel like has been properly covered. I'll, you know.
Uh-huh. Also, I guess you didn't split them up, but he, or did you have a conversation
Scout and
about
I just sat down the first day of the festival
oh, very good.
And went through them and mm-hmm. divided them up.
Did you get into a heated debate over a few of them? You must kind of, you guys both get to see them after all, but you know, you, yeah. how much is the urge to like reflect on them?
I think it was just easy to divide them up. I mean, mm-hmm. We were sort of happy with what we came out with.
Do you have different sensibilities in that regard too? Or
well, I don't know. What do you think, Scott?
I mean, it was a fairly intuitive yeah. process. They're really, you know, it was nice to be able to say, you know, oh, that one's the 3-hour period piece. Maybe you should do that one, et cetera. You know, mm-hmm. But no, they're really the big one was just figuring out who was going to do the U.S. premieres. But you know. Mm-hmm. Even that, really, you know, mm-hmm. it was fairly painless.
Were there any films that you shied away from that you didn't want to cover? Because
I occasionally will bow out of films where the makers are people that I know, and there was one or two of those this year.
That's very ethical of you.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to get put in some uncomfortable position.
Yeah. You must have been in that position before, right?
I've been in that position quite a bit.
And it's backfired a bit on you?
Oh, well,
potentially.
Only a couple of times. I mean, I actually years ago had a filmmaker friend say, you know, I so much respect your writing and opinion that please review my film, even if you don't give it a real good review. I'll be completely fine with that. And then the person never speaks to me again after I write an honest review. That has happened a couple of times. And so I would rather not have that happen.
Yeah, I could see that.
I'd rather recuse myself and maintain the friendship than, you know, be honest and lose a friend.
Right. Well, you keep the friendship, and also you never have to worry about perception. You know, if you're
exactly
you know. Right. So, were one of you going to cover the Laura Poitras film?
I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, because when we divided up, Scout had one more than I did. I think we had 15 films to cover, and he had 8, and I had 7. So this makes it an even Steven. 8 for each of us. Yeah.
Good. Glad. So, and then there's not too many other docs that you're going to cover, considering it's.
Are there any? Well, yes, I'm going to actually cover the Al Maisel's film,
yeah.
which is the only
Iris.
Other doc premiere here.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of makes sense.
Okay.
You know?
I don't know. Did we cover?
Well, you know, I'll go a couple places that you might want to. How this festival has evolved since the new regime took over 2 years ago. This is the second year.
Of Kent Jones. Regime, as you
well,
put it.
Well, yeah, that doesn't, yeah. word doesn't have any negative connotations.
No.
Well, what happened over the whole 52-year history of this festival is that the first 25 years were under Richard Rowd. He was the head of the selection committee, and it was very, very Eurocentric, and especially Francophilic. And then when Richard Pena took over, for the next 25 years, the festival became much more global and transnational, and he opened it up to, I think, lots of other countries that hadn't been included, and so it became a lot more multicultural and diverse, and I thought that was very good. And here in the last couple of years, it seems like they've been shifting back to a more Eurocentric vantage point. I mean, it's interesting if you look at the countries that are not represented in this festival, and they include you know, every country in Asia except for Korea. They include every country in North Africa, the Middle East, I think. You know, it's significant, I think, the couple of omissions that were big prize winners at Cannes, including Leviathan from Russia. There is no Russian film in this festival. Mm-hmm. And the Turkish film that won the Palme d'Or, that's not in the festival either, and there's no film from Turkey. So I sort of question the shift back to a Eurocentric emphasis in the festival. But on the other hand, I like a lot of the films that I'm seeing, and if I were on the selection committee, I may be voting on the basis of films rather than on trying to create more of a, you know. So I think that I didn't see all the films that they saw. I didn't have to make the choices that they do. I don't know if this is just a 2-year thing and it will become less Eurocentric in future years, depending on what films are out there or not. But I think that the omission of the Turkish and the Russian film is sort of indicative and maybe not in a particularly good way.
Well, something interesting is that of the major competitive festivals this year, none of the top prize winners are here.
Yeah.
you know, nothing from Venice or Locarno or Cannes or Berlin, the four majors. None of the films that walked away with the top prize are here. And, you know, there could be method to that, or it could be, you know, sort of an awareness that those films have, you know, a jumping off point already. They're, you know, they've taken home the most, you know, the highest possible honor that they could hope to have achieved by this point. So there's, yeah, it's interesting what's here and what's not.
Mm-hmm. It's open to speculation.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We, you know, we're just in the position of second guessing them without really doing it from an informed perspective. I'm just sort of observing what seems to be kind of a trend and sort of, you know, putting a question mark around it.
Right.
See where we'll go from here.
Right. How many years does a trend require, I wonder, or a pattern?
Well, I don't. Well, you know, 2 years is enough to constitute, you know, the appearance of a trend.
Yeah.
You
know? Right.
Yeah. We'll see where it goes from here. But it's very early into Kent Jones's tenure that we're talking about this.
Yeah. I didn't ask quite as pointed a question as that. I wish I had, but he did stand by that it's just a, you know, it's him and those four or five other on the selection committee, and mm-hmm. they just go by quality. They definitely keep out the demographic/geographical issues, though, or not supposedly a big issue. They don't really worry about where the films are coming in. Is everybody represented? But they just go look at quality.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you could end up, I suppose, I mean, arbitrarily with 10 films from France that same way, you know, but we're also at a very different point than when Raoud was right here, because back then, I mean, as far as America was concerned, French and Italian films were the majority of films that we were on our radar, maybe Japan.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
I mean,
it's much different now.
It is, yeah. Right? We have much more, like I know one of your areas of concentration is Iran. And,
yeah, you know, Iran is one of the countries that Richard Pena opened this festival to,
right.
And very valuably. And then last year I thought there were a couple of Iranian films that really deserved a place in this festival, including Manuscripts Don't Burn. And so we're here, it's 2 years of no Iranian films. So.
Yeah. We'll have to figure that out.
Yeah.
You want to keep Godfrey in the festival. Any other observations or germane type
of... Well, the other thing I wanted to bring up is that I was just talking with some other critics here before we started this conversation, is the relative paucity of press conferences. You know, when I first started coming to the festival, my first year, Godard, Truffaut, Kurosawa, every film had a press conference virtually. And
they Skyped those, though.
I'm just teasing. For
obviously,
many years,
yeah, 35 years ago, I guess.
And in recent years, it's been fewer press conferences. And last couple of years, they did Skype press conferences. And I think that they had some technical troubles with those. I don't know why they're not doing them this year. But I think having press conferences is a very good thing. And it's unfortunate. It used to be that the press got to talk to the filmmakers before, you know, anything hit the press about anything, you know. And now the filmmakers come in and they just have the conversations with the audiences at the public screenings. And so the critics are kind of shut out in a way that I think is unfortunate when you want to be able to hear a filmmaker talk about their work and be able to ask them
questions. But that's intellectual curiosity, right? Because that doesn't inform a review.
I think that, you know, if you're writing a review, the more you can understand about the film,
the
context and the intent and a lot of the background, the better informed you are, the better informed the review will be. And I think that those press conferences really served a purpose in that way of helping critics understand the filmmakers and what they're up to and, you know, a lot of the background of the film.
Yeah. I assume that they have cut out the Skype because of there were a lot of technical difficulties, or maybe they just saw that they were losing a lot of that they were poorly attended. I don't know.
No, they weren't poorly attended, and some of them were very, very useful and valuable. I remember the one last year for Room 237, or was that the year before? Anyway, that film was such an interesting film
last
to
year.
Talk about with the makers. You know, I remember that press conference very vividly. Melissa Anderson conducted it, and it was really good. And there were some others that were very good too that I regret that we don't have the
similar
chances.
I wonder if it's the sheer number of film festivals that these filmmakers are pulled into, and that it becomes increasingly harder to have as many press conferences. I don't know. No, like
I think if they want to have press conferences,
they can
have.
Huh? Yeah.
And I think the technical problems of this Skype thing are ones that can be overcome. You know, it's what you have technicians for.
Right. Or
fix the thing.
Or right, fix it, make it better. Yeah.
Make it work.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. They do have a bunch, but not at the number they did even a few years back.
Yeah, with far fewer than just fairly recently.
Yeah. In fact, I think they've only had one, maybe two.
Two, I believe, and I think so far, this afternoon for the Princess of France.
Oh, there is?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Mateus Pinheiro's film.
Yeah.
Okay.
So far, the Safdies did a conference,
right.
And
I was trying to remember
Ethan Hawke, yeah,
oh, yeah,
which
I
was
that.
A total delight. His film was great, and mm-hmm. then the press conference afterwards was kind of an extension of just how wonderful it is to kind of hear the two of them converse through the film and with each other. Yeah, that was excellent. I had no idea what to expect, and then I had the time of my life. So
great.
Seymour, an introduction. That's called. That was excellent.
A little known footnote about that film is that the two guys who edited my documentary Moving Midway, mm-hmm. Greg Lozier and mm-hmm. Ramsey Fendel, shot that film. Shot.
They're co-DPs.
They are co-credited with Cameron, yeah.
Oh, with Cameron. Very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were the DPs, in effect.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and they did
nice.
A really good job.
Yeah. As they did with Moving Midway. Yeah,
my
they
film.
Edited you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a well-edited documentary.
Yeah.
Godfrey.
Well, a lot of work went into that, that's for sure.
I bet.
They were great, though, by the way. They were just terrific to work with.
Well, thank you guys very much.
Sure.
We'll try to reconvene maybe at the end of the festival.
Okay.
Sure, yeah.
You
know,
be glad
you
to.
You guys are open to that idea. Yeah. Thank you, Godfrey.
Okay.
And thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. And thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You can check out RogerEbert.com for those reviews and others as well. Some of the top critics working today, right for there. I don't know where you go for reviews, but this is where I go. I read the New York Times reviews, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, IndieWire, always IndieWire, and Roger Ebert now in the last, I don't know, period of time. I've been checking into that site for reviews. So anyway, without any further delay, here's my conversation with Lucia Small regarding her film, One Cut, One Life.
It's one thing to learn that you have a terminal illness when you're 72. It's another thing to have your life taken early. You look for an explanation. You look for meaning.
I got diagnosed with MDS, which is a fatal disease. Okay, well, that's sobering. I desperately want 1 year of high spirit.
Maybe I would like to be with you guys more than you'd like me to be with you. No, I mean, for me, I know it's funny because here we have these cameras.
I'll say something selfish. I need you to lean on. It's okay.
It's okay. It's interesting when you do this line of work. It's so personal, and yet it's for the world to see, and you shape it and you form it, but you still feel very exposed. And even when people respond positively to it, it's, I like to say it's the third in a trilogy, in part because I think I'm done exploring this form, but I think in part because I think I can't do another one like this.
It's just too trying.
There's, when you're in the edit room and you're working, it's, and you're filming, it's kind of interesting because you're trying to
look at yourself as a character, as the world would see you, and try not to judge yourself. And that's a real interesting challenge, and of, you know, how you perceive yourself, how others perceive yourself. You want to make it a universal story. So at least I always do when I insert myself in my work. So that's always at the back of my mind. How does this feel universal? And one of the things that you have to keep saying is you're trying to be as vulnerable as you would like a subject to be with you. I mean, so many documentarians, I mean, the greatest moments in documentary are when you have such vulnerability with your characters. So I always try to make that happen within myself. And it's, I'm not as kind to myself as I am to others, actually. You know, you judge yourself, you judge your voice, you judge, you worry about perceptions, about how people, you know, will look at you, and you are going to be judged. And it's just an interesting path. And this particular piece, that was what Ed and I were both interested in, is how authentic can you get? How exposed, how intimate can you reveal yourself as the director? It's an incredibly complicated, but rewarding experience. I mean, to work with Ed, considered the father of this form, who had a very raw first magnum opus, you know, the
Diaries.
And
Well, it's interesting because when you bring this up about how transparent you try to be or open, it's interesting because you still have parameters, because, you know, you're telling this particular story, or you've told these particular stories in this trilogy, as you refer to it, and then people that, like myself, I suppose, that have watched them and see how much filmmakers like yourself and Ed have exposed themselves, we feel, oh, well, they exposed themselves completely, and, you know, they're 100% available. You know, it's not necessarily true. You do have parts of your life that are your own that you have to kind of keep to yourself, you know. But the perception is they're so available. I want, you know, they're available to me in that way. And, you know, even though, you know, on some level, of course, you're not. You're still just telling a particular story.
Yes.
So you know, if I ask you how you're doing and you have some sort of other issues going on, maybe emotionally, physically, what have you, it's not necessarily to be shared, even though I might just have to wait for that documentary to come out. If it does.
Well, if it does, it will be when I'm a lot older, I think. you know, one of the things that I am interested in is sort of this notion of truth and getting close to the truth, and how do you do that in this form? I mean, it's interesting because, you know, memoirs, you can get really personal, and people, it's a very internal experience reading a memoir. It's not the same experience when you're in a theater or even watching a film. It's a different kind of experience. So there's both this challenge to be, as we say, intimate or authentic, and then there's this challenge to entertain in a different way than a novel. And I'm not saying, or a memoir, I'm not saying that's not, they do that too. They want to create a story. They sort of choose what they're going to include, what they're going to exclude, etc. But it's more of a private space with a book. So
it's true. And I mean, you know, and on a very frank level, I mean, films are just marketed in a very much more, different. It's in a, just a different way. You know, it's hard to compare the two mediums, even though there is that similarity, you know, of revealing oneself, you know. Also, I mean, you know, in a memoir, I suppose, you can write about very personal things and how you handle, including other people in your life in that memoir, and then that story is similar to what you have to do. I mean, you're skirting a lot when you're editing this film. You know, not only are you telling your story, Ed's telling his story, because it is a co-directed film, but, you know, there's Jane's story is in there wrapped around, and there's this enormous tension. Jane is Ed's wife, mm-hmm. of 50 years, he's dying. We can just say that, that the you're in a kind of in a rush to finish the film as much as you can anyway, while Ed is able to do so. And Jane resents it because, you know, this is like that time where she probably wants him for herself. And to further complicate it, there is a history of this tension, even when Ed was healthy in your shared relationships, right? So that's sort of some of the background, too, which I guess...
Right. And shared relationships with me, but it took me a long time to learn that it wasn't just me, that it was other filmmakers that he collaborated with.
Oh, yeah.
That it had always been, and I thought it was more personal, but it wasn't. Yes, it was personal in a different way because I was a younger woman and we got along so well. And I was people say I was bringing him back to film, although, I mean, he was very dogged about wanting to come back and wanting and so excited about the prospect of being creative again.
So what you were saying, he was initially reluctant or?
No, he wasn't initially reluctant.
Okay.
Jane was.
She liked him planting flowers.
She liked him closer to home, I believe. That's what she told me. And she didn't want him to go away at any point, even when she was a very young woman and raising her two children. I mean, they didn't even have children at the point he first went to do his first film at age 27. And it was a very hard, taxing time and draining time on their marriage. I mean, that was their struggle as revealed in diaries many years later, but it started when he made his first film.
I understand, long before you entered the picture. But I do want to mention, though, and I, for the sake of exactly what you started talking about in terms of transparency, though, you are very, you're attractive younger woman, and also there's an appeal to your talent and your openness as a human being. And also, if you see Diaries, which I did, you know, there is some history there too of Ed's stepping out of his marriage. I don't want to in any way portray him as a philanderer, because I don't believe that's any way accurate. I actually think that it was very contextual to the time, to their relationship, to the people in their lives. But, I mean, I do think she struggled with that and probably...
I mean, they had what some people call an open marriage. I mean, Jane was seeking relations outside her marriage as well. And Ed probably much more frequently. So, yes, there was a history. There was a long history in that. And I wasn't interested in any of that triangulation at all. And that was something Ed and I established early on. But... it was interesting when I was going back to this footage from 10 years ago. There's some clips, and it's interesting. My nervousness about his excitement translates more as young girl admiring Ed. It was so fascinating to watch how my reserve translated on screen. And so I had to step back and say, oh, I hadn't even realized how some of my connection to him might have been translated to him and to Jane. I was, you know, excited. I just finished directing my first film. I had worked for years for other people, helping them make their work. And here I had just finished a film about my father, and the film had done pretty well. It had won several awards, and I was sort of ready to take documentary on. And here was a somewhat established filmmaker who wanted to work with me. So it was kind of a, it was a huge honor. But then it was, I would later say, was it an honor or was it a curse? It was hard because he had been a master and he had written the book and he had a legacy with people who had a history, a memory of history and documentary and knew his role. And it's funny because, you know, I was responding to Ross McElwee in a way. I loved Sherman's March. I thought it was so life-transforming when I saw it. And that, along with some other personal work, Crumb, for example, I thought was a fascinating film at the time. And so I was being influenced by those works. I didn't understand that Ross was, in a way, responding to Ed's
uber rawness in Diaries, almost unguardedness. And Ross responded to that in a way with more voiceover, with a character that he played, and with a lot more guidance through the footage that he was filming. And so I was interested in actually taking some of that guidance away and sort of having less of my voice intervene with my film about my father. And so it was a full circle, and it was a coincidence that we met on this jury, but it was something that was very exciting to me at the time, but nerve-wracking, because I understood that Jane was always in the picture. If I signed up to work with Ed, I was working with Jane and navigating around her ambivalence. So, yes.
At what point did you decide to include the two deaths that happened?
You mean the deaths of Karen
and Schmier?
Susan Wolf.
Susan Wolf, pardon me, I'm sorry. Karen Schmier and Susan Wolf. And, yeah, describe what went into that choice and that that there's a sort of another thread of in the film about your loss of these two friends during this time as well.
Right. Well, I didn't really want to make a film about their path, their dying, their being killed. They were killed within 7 weeks of each other. One by in a domestic, you know, Susan was killed by an ex-lover, and Karen was killed by this crazy, random, horrible accident, fluke accident.
Right.
But an accident that was associated with a petty robbery and a high-speed chase on the Upper West Side. It was one block from our apartment. So I think that both of those were incredibly shocking experience, and, I mean, horrible tragedies that these beautiful women lost their lives so early. And I, as a personal documentary filmmaker, I actually didn't want to tell this story. Mm-hmm. It impacted me so personally. And I saw the community of friends that came together around that, both of their deaths, in particular Karen's death, as it relates to my social milieu, a lot of mutual friends. We were all sharing this grieving period after Karen was suddenly killed. Susan, I didn't know as many of her friends, but I did become part of a network of friends too. I wanted to respect everybody in that circle. And so pulling out a camera at that time felt very questionable.
Right.
Very questionable. I mean, and you see a scene in the film, it's like, almost 2 months after both of them passed, that I finally pulled out the camera. In part because peers were encouraging me. I mean, Ed was encouraging me just to film it while it was happening and processing my grief, and even if it was to just put it away. And I mean, Doug Block, too, is a friend of mine, and he encouraged me, too. Mm-hmm. So I reluctantly pulled it out, and we had to do careful editing to sort of edit around how many apologies I had on the camera. Like, I don't know why I'm doing this. This doesn't feel right. But it felt like I wasn't really going to make a film about that. And then when Ed was diagnosed with this, you know, Ed was first diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Right.
And he had already been diagnosed with Parkinson's when my friends were killed. And so then he got this diagnosis, like shortly after Karen was killed, of this terminal illness and MDS. And so we started, it was very organic. He started to realize that something I had been nudging him to do for many years is to get his films all in order for Prosperity, that he started to think, okay, I need to do this. I need to do this now while I'm feeling healthy and I can travel back and forth to New York. It was an organic conversation that happened. Like, what about that film idea that we had where we try to do two people's lives and I film you and you film me? And it seemed like it had to have their stories in it. It was the only reason I wanted to do a film about about life in the face of death when Ed got diagnosed, because I had learned so much about death in life and the and how you have to go on and how life goes on but how it also totally transforms your world and totally shifts your view. So it evolved. I think it was the biggest challenge of the film about how to insert that story, because Ed's dying was clearly the current drama, if you will, the current story, if you will, that was happening as we were filming, and him navigating around his health issues and Jane's concerns and ambivalence towards the film, which clearly become a thread in the film too, and what is too private to make public, themes that we were always interested in started to emerge. And so in particular, these two stories, they were so delicate to me. Mm-hmm. And yet Ed's story clearly trumped their story at the moment. Mm-hmm. In terms of, that was my past. That is my past. This was his presence.
Yeah.
And this was his present reality. And so it was, you know, I'm talking in terms of story structure here and not in terms of value of life and death and who's, you know, I'm talking in terms of crafting a film around it.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, from the other angle though, there are not too many filmmakers that could, I don't think it'll occur to a lot of people watching the film, like, oh, that must have been sticky, you know what I mean? to start to discuss these two deaths of your friends, or maybe too soon, or any of those things, because we are on your side. You established this very successfully, not only within the context of this film, One Cut, One Life, but also just for those who have seen your films. We know you, we trust you, we understand how painful, you know, it is, and so you had that kind of ability.
Yes.
Where, you know, and I don't know if it would work quite so well with just any filmmaker, you know?
Well, thank you, Adam. I mean, I mean, some people trust me, some people don't, but I hope that everyone understands that I am trying to be honest and get to the truth of it. I mean, not to bring in an old film that people won't be seeing, but Axe in the Attic was pretty controversial in terms of my putting myself and Ed in the film itself. Some people loved it. Some people really didn't, strongly didn't. It was always the prickly challenge to trying to tell the story of the diaspora of Hurricane Katrina. But again, it's about that vulnerability. We felt like we were finding subjects at the brink of exhaustion, with total exasperation in their lives. They were incredibly vulnerable. They were in a state of shock. And we felt it was our duty to sort of reveal our vulnerabilities, not to trump their vulnerabilities or even compare our vulnerabilities to them, but just to honor their sharing with us.
Yeah.
Their ability to trust us. So we felt that would be a way for others who maybe weren't on the ground but wish they had been or wish they had done something, but to make it, you know, in a way, that same feeling when you're on a subway and someone's begging you for money and totally in need of every help, piece of help you can give them, quarters, dimes, $100 bills. I mean, and what do we do as human beings? We sort of evaluate, should I give this person money? Can I give this person money? What's my role as witness? What do I do? I mean, and as a documentarian, that's always what we're talking about. I mean, even when we're not filming ourselves, we're thinking about that in terms of our subjects. I mean, what is our role? Is our role just to tell the story? Or do we see when our subjects are in complete poverty, do we try to help them? And it's a very interesting dilemma that many documentarians are confronted with if they're doing, especially when they're doing cinema verite in the field of war torn areas and many more complicatedly difficult situations. I mean, right. I think the documentaries that are about political figures or stars or people that have more access to privilege and financial stability, I think those are a little different.
Right, but we'll allow you to show some angst in those films.
Yeah, we'll allow you to challenge the heads of the banks with inside job. You know, we'll allow you to get a little prickly with them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, to get a little Alex Gibney on them.
Yeah. This was Charles Ferguson, but yeah.
Yeah. No. I know. I'm just
respectfully.
Saying,
respectfully, I bow down to them, but I that's not the kind of filmmaker I am.
No. And it's. I think also you had the challenge. I think it was still relatively fresh wound, perhaps. I mean,
yes.
You know, nobody. Just time helps, you know, and people will look back at Axe in the Attic in a different light.
Yes. You know what? We haven't even said the name of the film yet.
I might have said it earlier, but I will in the intro too, so there's always that. One of the side effects of this type of podcast that I do is that I find it much smoother just to start talking than to do an abrupt sort of, you know, like clapboard type of start to the show because it just eases the way into the conversation, smoother way. And what will happen is because it's not normal in normal conversation to say, well, we're discussing my film, One Cut, One Life, co-directed by Ed Pincus and Lucia Small. But I'd rather, in other words, happen what just happened, which is we talk for, you know, a half hour and then, but it's really substantial and lose some of the marketing at the top because I can fix it later.
So, yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
But you can insert it throughout. And
it's interesting because, you know, starting a conversation, often I want to have the camera rolling.
Right.
I'm meeting people because some of the times that's the time before you typically start rolling the camera and you know, turn the camera off. It's amazing what happens before and after and, you know, how natural people are. And that's really kind of what we were trying to deal with in One Cut, One Life, you know, in this film. We were trying to not keep the cameras rolling all the time because we didn't. It was too exhausting. And we really did have to respect Jane's privacy. There were a lot of times I would not roll the camera, even though there were some interesting things happened, just to balance life with film.
Right. And you had to you constantly had to calibrate with her. So... It couldn't be done when she knows you're going to use the footage. So it had to be done off camera, just so you guys are kind of, you know, connected and emotionally. Yeah, no, that comes that comes through very, very well in the film.
Okay.
Yeah. We see that you're struggling with making sure that she's okay, and that there's this trust and that's maintained. You know.
You say you want a non-intimate relationship that feels like an intimate relationship.
I'm not saying it's not difficult.
Wait, did you turn this off? We turned it off.
I did?
Yeah. Were you filming me?
I don't know.
It's going to be different. You're not going to have the same abilities that you had. And I believe it was her idea to go ahead with this film. And
it was both our ideas.
Well, two days after they had found Susan, I went over to pick up Angus. Angus would shake all night long, and I'd sleep with him and hold him. This is my shrine of Susan and of Karen. You know, we became close, and it was when I finally decided to turn the camera off entirely. I mean, she was still asking me to turn it off sometimes, and I think at that point I said, you know, we have a film, and I'm not interested in filming him up until the point he's so sick. I wanted the memory of Ed to be vibrant and alive, and he was.
Yes,
he was. And, you know, I mean, I think when people watch Diaries, they wonder about who he is. he's more guarded, even though he feels like, I mean, he's on camera a lot, but he's younger and he's not as vulnerable as he was when he was sick. And I think some of his more emotive sides come out. He was going through, you know, obviously he was towards the end of his life, and he was in a different mode. And, you know, yet he's still Ed. Yet, you know, one of the most important things is I'm a filmmaker. That's what I do. And he'd often say, Lucia, you know, maybe people won't understand this, but we're committed to trying. And that was what I loved about him. He wasn't about the end game. He was and he wasn't, but he was about being committed to taking huge risks. And yet he always recognized that in part his more comfortable economic situation allowed him to do that. And he often would say, you know, you're the bigger risk taker. You don't have a husband. You don't, you know, you're out on your own. And I'd say, well, that's ridiculous. But, you know, we'd have this ongoing conversation about,
right.
I mean, we're lucky. We're lucky we get to do what we do. I understand that. And he did too. And we're lucky to be able to share it with the world, or, you know, with people who are interested in exploring the form of film as an art form, you know? So I don't know what I'm really trying to say here, but I just feel like why we truly connected is we were both interested in really pushing boundaries in this form and putting ourselves on the line in that process only if it would help others. You know, he also wanted to entertain. He said that every film he ever made was a comedy. And once people understand that, they'll understand everything. And in a way, we felt this was the comedy of our lives. The tragic comedy, maybe you want to say, but there's some crazy stuff in this film. I hope that people can relate to that in their own lives. I mean, we become very different people in our private worlds, and we all have vulnerabilities. And here you have, you know, Jane Pincus, the woman who helped write Our Bodies Ourselves with 12 other women and helped inform the whole feminist movement. And she's vulnerable as a wife and as a mother and as a wife of a filmmaker who wants to film her. So, and she's vulnerable towards me as a younger woman who might threaten her position. So it's kind of an amazingly interesting form of trying to get to the truths of our lives. And I think that part of our struggle is to sort of come to peace with the ambivalence we have. Not just Jane's ambivalence, but the ambivalence we have ourselves in terms of what's public, what's private, and what's authentic. I mean, I kind of roll my eyes at reality TV shows because I feel like, you know, it's the new quote unquote documentary that many people are feeling is true to life. Now it's totally disappeared from that. But initially, when it was starting, there are some really good, there were some good reality TV shows. I believe, I don't watch, well, 16 I'm Pregnant, I've watched that a couple of times. A good friend of mine makes that show. She's trying to, you know, inform people about options.
She's trying to sneak in some agenda in there.
She wanted women to have, I mean, she's a strong feminist, and she wanted women to have a choice. She wanted to have a woman have a choice that she got when she was 16, because she had guidance.
Who is she?
Dia Sokol, who's in the Sokol Savage, who's seen in the film. She became a dear friend because we were mutual friends with Karen.
Okay.
And she's trying on her wedding dress, and she comes to my house to comfort me. She's one of the subjects in my film who I became closer to as a result of Karen's passing.
Well, again, the name of the film is One Cut, One Life.
Mm-hmm.
The title referring to a philosophical reference right? To martial art practice.
Yeah, Aikido. Aikido. One cut. Yeah, it's a sword. A sword movement. And I don't want to butcher it either. I mean, Ed used to also say, it's not Taekwondo, it's Aikido.
I'd like to read this quote because sure. It comes up not in the film. The quote, though, for about the title is, there is this notion in Japanese swordsmanship called one cut, one life. Everything could be the last time. Everything counts. Everything has meaning. And it goes on, but I mean, I think that's, you know, very moving section of the film, too.
Yeah,
I'm learning that myself. Yeah, I'm learning that myself in the in these days. What were you going to say?
Oh no, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was also going to say you were mentioning Jane before. She also was, you know, not only the wife of a filmmaker, a feminist, all these different things. She was also about to lose her husband. So, you know, there was that part of her vulnerability too, which.
Yes.
You know, you had to honor and
yes.
navigate, you know.
Yes.
The film is going to have its New York premiere in this little festival that's playing at Lincoln Center, right? Called the New York Film Festival.
Yes, it is.
Tickets are sold out. That's a nice problem.
I don't want to. I mean, I think that standby is a good option. I know that. A lot of people can get in and stand by, I'm hoping.
So if you're listening and you're eager to see the film, and why wouldn't you, for God's sake, why wouldn't you be? It's Monday, September 29th at 6 o'clock at the Eleanor Bunnan Monroe Theater at Lincoln Center. You'll be there.
I will be there. And Ed's son, Ben Pincus, who's an Aikido master,
will
be there. And his daughter, Sammy Pincus, will also be there. And my producer, Mary Kerr, will be there. So,
now, you didn't mention Jane, so I...
No, Jane does not want to come, and
understood.
I respect that.
Sure.
She's, yeah.
Yeah, but certainly let's visit again, though, when, you know, we have another part of the plan in place with the film, meaning like a broadcast or, you know, maybe another festival or screening or...
Well, this is, I mean, yeah, the New York Film Festival is such a lovely, lovely honor. I mean, it's huge. And I feel like this film is tough. It's complicated and tough and funny, yet not funny. It's disturbing. you know, I've had many different definitions around it, but I like to think it's an affirmation of life. And
right.
It's sort of what we're all dealing with. At different ages, and it was such a, I know Ed would be so proud that it's in the New York Film Festival. I mean,
yeah.
he had his first film, Black Matches, there, and then we, of course, played Axe in the Attic there, and just going back to New York Film Festival, it's to me, I mean, it's been wonderful to, you know, to premiere at Full Frame and attend a few other festivals, but this has been particularly emotional for me. I mean, all of them are, actually. So what am I saying? Each
well,
time you watch the
right.
film,
they're,
Ed comes alive, and it's nice to have his legacy live in the content and the form itself. That's what I like to say, that it is a film that experiments with two points of view, and it experiments, you know, not very many personal docs go there because it's really complicated to have two stories intertwined. It was not an easy edit, but luckily too, we had some great help. We got into the Sundance Labs. That was like a highlight. They were able to help me find my voice, because Ed's voice, we always wanted to do Ed's voice first. We always wanted to tell Ed's stories first in case he got sicker and wasn't able to tell his. Like, I knew I could pick up the film after he passed. So we always concentrated on that. And so trying to find my voice in it and make it balance in a fluid way was a huge challenge. And so, I mean, the fact that it came together and it was, you know, it's just it's just a nice story to have it play at the New York Film Festival. So,
well, congratulations. And I think it's wonderful, and it is great to see it back. And I remember meeting you around the time of Axe in the Attic and really being impressed by that film as well when I saw it there.
Well, thank you, Adam. You're I know. Welcome. We met at the Tavern on the Green. That was fun.
Yeah. Maybe that'll happen again. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to work it so I get to go again, because I don't think they've had the party at the Tavern on the Green in quite a few years, so.
Right, I know. I guess it's back there. So, did we cover everything you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I mean, honestly.
Was it an okay interview? I'm sorry.
It was lovely. It was lovely. I think, I do think you're talking about navigating the personal documentary form is important, because, you know, there are a lot of filmmakers out there. I even think narrative filmmakers can learn a thing or two.
Right.
So, yeah, no, I think it was great. And
okay.
I'm very happy. I'm very happy that you were able to finally come on and we finally got it together.
Me too. I really appreciate your persistence and I appreciate your interest, because, you know, it's interesting the way I started it. You asked me how I'm doing, and I'm doing okay. I'm really grateful that I got to do this film, like incredibly grateful, but it's challenging to be in the world without Ed.
Yeah. And you know, Karen and right.
Yeah, and Karen and Susan.
Susan, I mean, you went through.
Yeah.
And then you wonder, you know, I mean, it's almost like uninformed to ask if this was cathartic, because that level of loss and grief, and you know, you just don't really rebound from that quite. You become a changed person.
Right.
I don't, you know, I'm sure there's some catharsis too, but like, get rid of all the pain that you in such a short amount of time, you know, had to encounter. My goodness.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, one question that came out of an audience once was, did it help? And I was like, huh, I'm hoping it will help others, actually.
Which would in turn maybe help you, right? You know, knowing.
Yeah,
you.
That would be, so I'm living with a very real reality, and not that, you know, everyone suffers. Everyone goes through their own trauma, I mean, or their own journey. I mean, the film starts out with a quote, you know, and there could be a novel by Tolstoy in everyone's life. And that is what I'm interested in. Everybody has these intricate threads that they navigate, you know, about life and death and loss and,
yeah,
and purpose and family and creativity, not, you know, or family and work. I mean, it's a balancing act that we all sort of navigate in different economic tiers, but it's something that that is not cathartic, actually. It's perhaps healing a little bit, but it's also opening wounds. So that's it's not running away from a pain, it's sort of facing it.
Yeah, very well said. And I think there's something to tearing the Band-Aid off in a way, because you need to let a wound, you need to expose it to oxygen, you know, and
right,
like light, and let it just, it takes a long time to heal. But yeah, you're kind of, you're opening it up to that, to they're creating a rawness in a way.
I love the fact that you said light, because I think that's probably a nice way to end this conversation, because Ed was, he said his films were about comedy, but they were also always about the light.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there's a healing aspect to it, it's that we were able to, that he was able to make a film in his last years, that I was able to help that, and that there is a lightness in this process, and there is a lightness in the story and the humor and the errors that we make and the vulnerability and the absurdity that we go through as human beings, but also the deep value of our lives. So there is a lightness in this piece too, which there's beautiful shots of light. And I say, you know, leave it to Ed Pincus to not be able to hold his camera on his shoulder anymore and shoot on a tripod some of the most beautiful shots in the film.
Thank you, Lucia.
Thank you.
One Cut, One Life. And we'll come back together soon, right?
Okay, thanks a lot.
I think in the intro I might have alluded to the fact that One Cut, One Life is directed by Lucia Small, which is true, but it's co-directed by Ed Pincus. It's his last work, and I wanted to set that straight for the record. Coming up next on episode number 242, the filmmaker Michael Belandic, who has his second feature. It's called Hellaware. I saw it at BAM Cinema Fest last spring, and it stars Keith Polson and Sophia Decal. Michael will be on the show. It's a Fandor-sponsored episode. We'll post that show in just a few days since it premieres on Fandor on Friday, as well as playing for 1 week theatrically in New York at the Cinema Village. So if you're living locally, go catch Hellaware. That's coming up and much more in the coming weeks. Thank you for tuning in regularly. Please do recommend my podcast, if you would, to your friends and family, whoever enjoys seeing films and hearing maybe about the process of making them and getting them out there in the world. That's what the show is essentially about. You can find us on iTunes, of course, if you just search Filmwax Radio in the iTunes store. You can subscribe to the show. And if you do, if you're on iTunes, put a star rating. If you even feel like making the extra effort, a little comment would be nice. And of course, you can always find us on Facebook. Also, you can find us on Twitter at Filmwax Radio. And if you want to shoot me a note, I'm at adam@filmwax.com, so you can do that. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate it. Thanks very much. We'll be back in a few days with Michael Belandic. Thanks for listening. This is Adam Shartoff, your host for Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Till next time.
I miss you more than you could know. I watch the grass on the back lawn grow, and I will not allow winds of change to blow. And I hope you decide to come back home. 'Cause this heavy heart, our house yearn, 'cause I've been alone far too long. When are you coming home, my love? My love. Out for me in the night, and an errant finger pokes me in the eye, and I leave your contact lenses on the bedside table, and I'm hoping you decide to come back home. 'Cause this heavy heart, our house yearns.